Have you ever watched someone perform at an extraordinary level and wondered, were they born with that ability? From Mozart composing symphonies as a child to Ray Allen's perfect basketball jump shot, we often attribute exceptional performance to innate talent, some mysterious gift bestowed at birth. But what if this fundamental assumption about human potential is completely wrong? Anders Ericsson's peak has become a cultural phenomenon, influencing everyone from corporate CEOs to Olympic athletes. Bill Gates included it in his 5 books worth reading this summer, and countless performance coaches cite it as their Bible. The book's central message, that greatness isn't born but systematically developed, has revolutionized how we think about human achievement and learning. Through decades of groundbreaking research studying the world's top performers, Ericsson discovered something remarkable. The gift of exceptional ability isn't what we think it is at all. The belief that exceptional performers possess innate gifts runs deep in our culture. We watch Mozart composing symphonies at age 5 or Ray Allen sinking perfect jump shots and assume they must have been born with special abilities. But this assumption crumbles under scientific scrutiny. Consider perfect pitch, the ability to identify musical notes without reference, long considered an innate talent that Mozart possessed. In the 1990s, Japanese psychologist Ayako Sakakibara demonstrated that children under 6 could develop perfect pitch through specific training methods. All 24 children in her study acquired this supposedly inborn gift. What's actually happening is that the brain physically rewires itself in response to specific types of training. While some abilities, like perfect pitch, must be developed before age 6, the brain retains remarkable adaptability throughout life. Even Ray Allen, whose jump shot appears so natural to people assumed he was born with it, actually had terrible shooting form as a rookie. Through relentless daily practice, he transformed his awkward shot into something so graceful that people mistook it for innate talent. This pattern repeats across domains. What appears to be natural talent is actually the result of specific training that leverages the brain's adaptability. The real gift we all possess is not some predetermined ability, but rather our capacity to develop new capabilities through proper training. This fundamentally changes how we should think about potential, not as a fixed entity determined at birth, but as an expandable vessel shaped by our activities and practice. In the early 1980s, a young Carnegie Mellon undergraduate named Steve Falloon participated in a memory experiment that would dramatically challenge conventional wisdom about human capabilities. When first tested, Steve could remember about 7 random digits, the normal human capacity. But after consistent training sessions where he was pushed just beyond his current ability, something remarkable happened. In his 5th session, he successfully recalled an 11-digit string, breaking through what was thought to be a fixed cognitive limit. Over 2 years and more than 200 training sessions, Steve steadily improved until he could remember an astonishing 82 random digits presented at 1 per second, far beyond what anyone, even professional mnemonists, had achieved at that time. This experiment demonstrated that supposed cognitive limits could be dramatically expanded through consistent, focused practice. This pattern of dramatic performance improvement appears across domains. Johnny Hayes's 1908 Olympic marathon record would barely qualify for today's Boston Marathon. Diving moves once considered dangerous are now performed by children. Classical pianist Alfred Cortot's recordings, once definitive, would be considered technically sloppy by today's standards. Memory champions have progressed from memorizing 511 digits of pi in 1973 to over 70,000 digits today. These extraordinary improvements didn't come from genetic evolution, but from increased training time and more sophisticated practice techniques. The key is what Ericsson calls purposeful practice, which has several distinct characteristics. First, it pushes you outside your comfort zone in a focused way. Unlike casual practice, where you repeat what you already know, purposeful practice targets specific aspects of performance that need improvement. Second, it requires clear goals, not vague intentions like get better, but specific objectives like increase typing speed to 75 words per minute. Third, it demands your full attention and conscious monitoring of results. Finally, it requires feedback, either from yourself or others, to identify errors and make corrections. When facing barriers to improvement, the key is finding new approaches rather than just trying harder. When Steve hit plateaus in his digit memory, researchers helped him overcome them by slightly slowing digit presentation or giving him longer strings to prove his capabilities weren't maxed out. Similarly, violin teacher Dorothy DeLay demonstrated to a student that he could play faster than he thought by gradually increasing metronome speed until he was playing faster than Itzhak Perlman. While obstacles are natural in any improvement process, true immovable limits are rare. People typically just give up. Maintaining motivation through positive feedback, internal satisfaction, or external recognition is crucial for sustaining the effort required. Steve's athletic background, financial compensation, enjoyment of improvement, and media recognition all contributed to his persistence in the memory study. The brain adapts to mental training much like muscles respond to physical exercise, though these changes aren't visible like physical development. Brain imaging techniques now allow neuroscientists to study structural and functional changes in the brain resulting from specific types of training. London's taxi drivers provide a fascinating example of this adaptability. To become licensed, drivers must pass the knowledge, requiring them to memorize all streets, landmarks, buildings, and points of interest within a 6-mile radius of Charing Cross, approximately 25,000 streets. Prospective cabbies spend years driving through London on motorbikes, taking detailed notes on optimal routes and landmarks. Brain scans show that successful taxi drivers develop significantly enlarged posterior hippocampi, the brain region responsible for spatial navigation compared to bus drivers who follow fixed routes. This neuroplasticity extends to other domains as well. Studies of blind people reveal how their visual cortex gets repurposed for processing touch sensations, particularly when reading Braille. Three-fingered Braille readers develop such expanded brain areas for their reading fingers that the regions overlap, creating exceptional touch sensitivity. Musicians develop enlarged cerebellums and increased gray matter in sensory and motor regions. Mathematicians show more gray matter in the inferior parietal lobule, the same region unusually large in Einstein's brain. Glider pilots develop increased gray matter in regions controlling stick movements and visual balance integration. This adaptability stems ironically from the body's preference for stability. Homeostasis, the body's tendency to maintain steady internal conditions, means systems resist change until pushed beyond their comfort zone. When vigorous physical activity strains homeostatic mechanisms, cells experience abnormal states with low oxygen and energy compounds. These stressed cells activate different genes, up to 112 in one rat study, triggering metabolic changes, structural alterations, and new cell formation. For continued improvement, you must continuously increase challenges, run farther, faster, uphill, staying just outside your comfort zone without risking injury. Once compensatory changes occur, the body becomes comfortable again, and progress stops unless you keep pushing the boundaries. Understanding the brain's adaptability fundamentally changes how we view human potential. Most people develop only enough capability for daily activities and weekend recreation. They can't run a 5-minute mile or perform athletic feats not because they lack capacity, but because they're satisfied living in the comfortable rut of homeostasis. The same applies to mental activities. From writing reports to performing surgery, we learn just enough to get by. This reveals the key difference between traditional learning and deliberate practice. Traditional approaches don't challenge homeostasis, assuming we're simply fulfilling innate potential within our comfort zone. Deliberate practice, however, aims to build potential itself, making possible what wasn't before by forcing adaptation. On April 27, 1924, Russian Grandmaster Alexander Alekhine performed an astonishing feat of chess mastery, playing 26 skilled opponents simultaneously without seeing any of the boards. For over 12 hours, he tracked 832 pieces across 1,664 squares entirely from memory, winning 16 games, losing 5, and drawing 5. How is such a feat possible? Research by Herb Simon and Bill Chase revealed that chess grandmasters don't possess superhuman memory for random chess pieces. When shown boards from actual games, masters could recall about two-thirds of piece positions after just 5 seconds, while novices remembered only about 4 pieces. However, when pieces were arranged randomly, masters performed no better than novices, remembering just 2 or 3 pieces. This demonstrates that chess expertise relies on recognizing meaningful patterns rather than memorizing individual pieces, similar to how we more easily remember coherent sentences than random words. Through years of analyzing master games, players accumulate approximately 50,000 chunks, patterns of chess pieces stored in long-term memory and organized hierarchically. These mental representations allow masters to instantly assess positions, identify advantages, and calculate potential moves far more effectively than novices. Mental representations are brain structures corresponding to objects, ideas, or information we're thinking about. They range from simple visual images, like picturing the Mona Lisa, to complex concepts, like understanding what dog means. Through deliberate practice, we develop increasingly efficient mental representations specific to our domain of expertise. Steve Falloon created sophisticated digit encoding systems, London taxi drivers build detailed mental maps, and competitive divers form precise mental models of body positioning and momentum. Crucially, these representations are domain-specific. A chess player's mental models won't help with general spatial tasks, and memory techniques for digits don't transfer to letters. This explains why there's no such thing as developing general skills. You don't train memory broadly, but rather for specific types of information. What sets experts apart is the quality and quantity of their mental representations, which allow them to process large amounts of information quickly despite short-term memory limitations. Professional baseball hitters don't have better eyesight or reflexes than average people, but their sophisticated mental representations let them instantly recognize pitch types and trajectories from subtle cues in the pitcher's delivery. Experts excel at seeing meaningful patterns where novices see only random elements. In team sports like soccer, elite players instantly recognize shifting patterns of player movements and respond appropriately. In indoor rock climbing, experienced climbers automatically categorize handholds by grip type without conscious thought, while their brains simultaneously prepare their hands for the appropriate grip. Mental representations don't just result from learning, they actively facilitate it. Musical performance research shows that advanced musicians develop detailed mental representations of how pieces should sound, allowing them to provide their own feedback during practice. The more accomplished music students can better identify mistakes and difficult sections, indicating more developed mental representations. This creates a virtuous circle. Better skills lead to better mental representations, which enable more effective practice, further honing skills. What separates purposeful practice from truly effective training? The gold standard approach that produces exceptional results is what Erickson calls deliberate practice. While Steve Falloon's digit memorization reached 82 digits through purposeful practice, modern memory competitors have surpassed 300 digits, with the world record at 432. The difference lies in their training methods. The most effective training methods emerge in fields with specific characteristics: objective performance measures, competitive incentives, established traditions, and sophisticated teaching techniques developed over time. Musical training, particularly for violin and piano, exemplifies these principles perfectly. In a landmark study, Erickson and colleagues interviewed 30 student violinists at different skill levels. Best students with international soloist potential, better students who were very good but not exceptional, and good students from the music education department. They also included professional violinists from renowned Berlin orchestras as a comparison group. All groups agreed that solitary practice was most crucial for improvement. Most strikingly, all students, regardless of skill level, found practice labor-intensive and not enjoyable. They were motivated by seeing it as essential to improvement, not because they loved practicing. The single significant difference between the three groups was their accumulated practice time. By age 18, the best students had practiced 7,410 hours on average, compared to 5,031 hours for the better students and 3,420 hours for the music education students. The professional orchestral violinists had averaged 7,336 hours, nearly identical to the top students. These findings have been replicated across various performance domains, from ballet dancers to chess players. No one develops extraordinary abilities without tremendous practice. Even Bobby Fischer, considered by many the greatest chess player in history and the youngest grandmaster of his time, studied intensively for 9 years before reaching that level. While deliberate practice in its strictest sense is only possible in certain fields with established teaching methods and developed skills, the principles can guide effective practice in any area. 1. Practice with specific, well-defined goals. 2. Focus intently on improving particular aspects of performance. 3. Get immediate, informative feedback. 4. Develop effective mental representations. 5. Work with a teacher who designs appropriate practice activities. When identifying experts to learn from, beware of subjective judgments prone to biases. Research shows people are influenced by education, experience, recognition, and even attractiveness when judging competence. In many fields, supposed experts perform no better than less credentialed practitioners when measured objectively. Wine experts often can't consistently rate identical wine samples, licensed therapists are no more effective than minimally trained laypeople, and financial experts rarely outperform novices at stock picking. The lesson is clear. Seek objective performance measures whenever possible. In fields without clear metrics, get creative. Consult peers who can directly observe performance. Find professionals who work with many others and can make comparisons, or identify who experts themselves turn to when facing difficult situations. The Vietnam War in 1968 presented the U.S. Navy with a critical problem. Their fighter pilots were losing dogfights at an alarming rate, with kill ratios dropping from 2-1 to 1-1 against North Vietnamese MiGs. The solution became the famous Top Gun School, which embodied deliberate practice principles by allowing pilots to engage in realistic combat scenarios without fatal consequences. The program selected the best pilots as trainers who flew MiG-like aircraft using Soviet tactics, while the next best pilots were students. Instead of missiles, planes carried cameras to record encounters. The key to improvement came through rigorous after-action reports, where trainers would relentlessly question students about their decisions and mistakes, using film and radar data as feedback. The results were dramatic. By 1970-1973, Navy pilots achieved a 12.5-1 kill ratio, while the Air Force maintained their previous 2-1 ratio. By 1972, Navy pilots averaged 1.04 kills per encounter, essentially downing an enemy plane every time they engaged. This Top Gun approach offers a solution for applying deliberate practice in professional settings. Instead of analyzing what makes experts great, create training programs that mimic real situations and allow extensive practice with immediate feedback. Consider breast cancer detection through mammogram interpretation. Some radiologists are significantly more accurate than others, but traditional experience doesn't necessarily improve performance, because radiologists rarely receive feedback on their diagnoses. The solution? creating libraries of digitized mammograms with known outcomes that radiologists can practice interpreting repeatedly while receiving immediate feedback. Similarly, doctors at Morgan Stanley Children's Hospital assembled 234 pediatric ankle X-ray cases for resident training. Residents would diagnose each case and immediately receive expert feedback, dramatically improving their diagnostic accuracy through consistent practice. For laparoscopic surgery, researchers identified that many bile duct injuries resulted from visual perceptual illusions, where surgeons mistook one body part for another. Expert surgeons developed techniques to obtain clearer views during procedures. This knowledge enables targeted training using surgery videos that stop at critical decision points, allowing surgeons to practice hundreds of challenging scenarios safely. The Top Gun approach emphasizes doing rather than knowing. This distinction between knowledge and skills represents the fundamental difference between traditional paths towards expertise and deliberate practice. Traditional education focuses almost exclusively on knowledge, providing information about correct procedures and expecting students to apply it. Deliberate practice, by contrast, concentrates entirely on performance improvement through structured, feedback-rich practice.
Deliberate practice isn't just for prodigies or large organizations, it's for anyone who wants to improve their skills and reach their potential. The most important first step is finding a good teacher. Even motivated and intelligent students advance more quickly under the guidance of someone who knows the best learning sequence, can demonstrate proper technique, provide useful feedback, and design practice activities targeting specific weaknesses. Look for teachers who are accomplished in their field, have teaching experience, and can provide specific practice exercises for you to work on between sessions. As you advance, you may need to change teachers to continue improving. The goal is to find someone who can help you develop your own mental representations so you can eventually monitor and correct your own performance. Deliberate practice requires complete engagement and focus. Research comparing amateur and professional singers revealed that while both felt energized after lessons, only amateurs reported feeling elated. Professionals remained focused on technique rather than enjoyment. This principle applies across all domains. If your mind wanders or you're just having fun, you likely won't improve. Olympic swimmer Natalie Coughlin transformed her performance when she stopped daydreaming during laps and instead focused intensely on perfecting each stroke. This level of concentration is exhausting. Shorter, more focused practice sessions are more effective than longer periods of partial attention. Once you can no longer focus effectively, it's best to end the session. When a teacher isn't available, you can design your own deliberate practice, as Benjamin Franklin did to improve his writing. Franklin would analyze exemplary writing from the spectator, create brief descriptions of sentences, then attempt to reconstruct the articles from these hints and compare his versions with the originals. He'd also transform prose into poetry to expand his vocabulary, then convert back to prose. These exercises systematically addressed specific weaknesses, eventually making him one of early America's most admired writers. The hallmark of such self-directed practice is trying something beyond your comfort zone repeatedly, focusing precisely on execution, identifying shortcomings, and making improvements. The key principles are focus, feedback, fix it. Break skills into components you can analyze, determine weaknesses, and address them systematically. When improvement stops, many people believe they've hit their natural limit and settle for life on that plateau. But plateaus are typically surmountable with the right approach. The key to moving beyond plateaus is identifying exactly what's holding you back, what mistakes you're making, and when. Push yourself outside your comfort zone to see what breaks down first, then design targeted practice techniques aimed at improving that specific weakness. Maintaining motivation over the long term is perhaps the biggest challenge. Social motivation is particularly powerful. Surrounding yourself with supportive people who share your interests creates built-in accountability and encouragement. For solo practice, concrete signs of improvement maintain motivation. Breaking long journeys into manageable goals with small rewards works well. Dan McLean of The Dan Plan meticulously tracked his golf progress through spreadsheets and handicap measurements, turning an abstract goal into visible progress markers.
In the late 1960s, Hungarian psychologist Laszlo Polgár and his wife Klára embarked on an ambitious experiment to prove his theory that any child could be turned into a genius with proper training. They raised their three daughters, Susan, Sophia, and Judith, to become chess champions. The results were remarkable. Susan became the top-ranked female player at 15 and the first woman to earn grandmaster status through the same qualification path as men. Judith, the crown jewel of Laszlo's experiment, became a grandmaster at 15 years, 5 months, at that time the youngest person ever to reach that level. She was ranked number one among women for 25 years and once reached 8th in the world overall among all chess players. The development of expertise typically follows distinct stages. The first stage begins with playful introduction to what will become their field of interest. Susan Polgár found chess pieces and initially liked their shapes as toys before becoming fascinated with their logic. Parents play a crucial role during this stage by giving time, attention, and encouragement while instilling values like self-discipline and hard work. Having older siblings provides additional motivation and learning opportunities. Judith had Susan and Sophia, Mozart had Maria Anna, Serena Williams followed Venus, and Michaela Schifrin had her brother Taylor. Younger siblings often achieve more, possibly because parents learn from experience and the younger children benefit from watching, learning from, and competing with their more skilled siblings. Once a child shows promise and interest, the typical next step is taking lessons from a coach or teacher, marking their first encounter with deliberate practice. These initial instructors aren't necessarily experts themselves, but they excel at motivating children and keeping them engaged as they adapt to the work of improvement. In their early to mid-teens, future experts make a major commitment to becoming the best they can be. This marks the transition to seeking out the very best teachers or schools, even if it requires moving across the country. These teachers have typically reached the highest levels in their field and accept only students they believe can reach similar heights. Expectations gradually increase until students are doing everything humanly possible to improve. The motivation now comes entirely from within, though families often provide crucial support, sometimes moving to accommodate training and bearing substantial costs. While experts typically begin training as children, adults can still develop impressive skills through deliberate practice. The adult brain may not be as adaptable in certain ways as a child's, but it remains capable of learning and changing. The case of perfect pitch illustrates this. Though traditionally viewed as impossible to develop after childhood, Paul Brady proved otherwise at age 32 through consistent, targeted practice. When presenting on deliberate practice and expertise, Erickson was invariably asked about natural talent. His consistent message was that expert performers develop extraordinary abilities through years of dedicated practice, improving step by step without shortcuts. The legendary violinist Niccolo Paganini was said to have continued playing beautifully even as his violin strings snapped one by one until he finished on just a single string. This seemingly magical feat suggested extraordinary innate talent. However, investigation reveals Paganini deliberately composed pieces for fewer strings, including Love Scene, written for just the G and E strings. His broken string performances were carefully planned showmanship. He would intentionally break strings during performances of specially written pieces. Mozart remains the quintessential prodigy whose young accomplishments seem inexplicable without assuming innate talent. While he impressed European audiences from age 6 with his keyboard and violin playing, his achievements appear less miraculous when compared to today's Suzuki-trained children. Mozart had an advantage. His father, Leopold, who wrote a book on teaching music to children and began Wolfgang's training before age 4. Mozart's first unequivocally original compositions appeared when he was 15 or 16, after a decade of intensive training.
Donald Thomas's story initially seems to defy the 10,000-hour rule. As a basketball player who cleared 7 feet in the high jump with no apparent training, he won competitions wearing basketball shoes and became world champion just a year after discovery. However, examining his case reveals he had previously competed in high school high jump, clearing 6'2" to 6'4". His basketball dunking, taking off on 1 foot from great distances, provided transferable training for high jumping. People with savant syndrome appear to possess extraordinary magical abilities despite cognitive challenges. However, research reveals these abilities result from obsessive practice, not innate talent. Studies found autistic savants are more detail-oriented and prone to repetitive behaviors than non-savant autistic individuals. Calendar calculator Donnie, for instance, is addicted to dates, constantly thinking about them, and has memorized all 14 possible yearly calendars. While prodigies supposedly demonstrate innate talent, anti-prodigies represent the opposite, people who believe they lack natural ability in certain areas. About 1/6 of American adults believe they can't sing, often because an authority figure told them they were tone deaf. However, true tone deafness, congenital amusia, is exceedingly rare. Most self-proclaimed tone deaf people simply gave up singing after discouragement. Chess is popularly associated with genius, but research shows practice is the dominant factor in chess skill. While higher IQ children initially learn chess faster, this advantage disappears among elite players. The key difference is that experienced players develop sophisticated mental representations that bypass raw intellectual processing. The belief in innate talent creates dangerous self-fulfilling prophecies. Children labeled as untalented are steered away from activities they struggle with initially, ensuring they never develop those skills. Conversely, those labeled talented receive more attention, praise, and opportunities, seemingly confirming the initial assessment. Deliberate practice principles can revolutionize education and performance across domains. In a remarkable educational experiment at the University of British Columbia, students taught using deliberate practice methods learned more than twice as much as those in traditional lectures, the largest effect ever seen in an educational intervention. A world embracing deliberate practice would contain far more experts across all fields with enormous societal implications. Imagine if 50% of doctors, teachers, engineers, and other professionals performed at levels only the top 5% achieve today. The personal benefits would be tremendous too. Experts experience great satisfaction from pushing their abilities and sometimes reach flow states during performance. Humans are most human when improving ourselves. Unlike any other species, we can consciously change and improve in ways we choose. This capacity distinguishes us from every other species alive today or in history. The classic conception of human nature is captured in our name, Homo sapiens, knowing man. But perhaps we should see ourselves as Homo exercens, practicing man, the species that takes control through practice. In a rapidly changing world where careers change multiple times in a lifetime, we must prepare by learning to learn efficiently. We need better training techniques based on deliberate practice principles for adults already working, and we must give children confidence in their ability to remake themselves repeatedly. The ultimate result may be a society where people understand they control their development, the true power of deliberate practice.